This CLE course is based on the summaries of appellate decisions released by our appellate courts in July of 2019 addressing issues in criminal law. The summaries were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in July, and they have since been compiled into an update pamphlet, and it is that July 2019 criminal law update pamphlet which constitutes the written materials for this course, and the page references are to that pamphlet. The first case is on page 8. The defendant was charged with aggravated cruelty to animals, and he raised a justification defense, which the court determined did not apply to the offense. And the other interesting point in the case was it held that the pre-sentence interview at the probation department is not a critical stage of the proceeding, and therefore the attorney was not required to be present for that. This is a third department case. Again, the defendant's conviction of aggravated cruelty to animals, which is Agriculture and Markets Law 353-A, it again noted that the justification defense on which the jury was instructed applies only to persons, not animals. And the defendant unsuccessfully argued the pre-sentence report should have been ignored because his attorney wasn't present during the interview at the probation department. The court wrote, defendant contends that the court should have disregarded the report in its entirety and ordered a new one because the probation department did not abide by counsel's request to be present for the pre-sentence interview. New York's right to counsel applies to every critical stage of the criminal proceeding. However, in light of the non-adversarial nature of a routine pre-sentence interview by a probation officer, courts have held that such an interview does not constitute a critical stage of the proceedings. Therefore, defendant did not have a right to have counsel present during the interview. In any event, county court granted defendant's request to strike the portion of the report containing defendant's statement related to the crime. Next is the Gonzalez case on pages 10 and 11. It has to do with the weight of the evidence. The defendant's conviction was reversed by the appeals court after they found that the conviction was against the weight of the evidence. Fourth Department, over a two-justice dissent, reversed defendant's manslaughter conviction. The defendant had been alone with the victim, his girlfriend's 13-month-old son, for a short time on the day the baby vomited and was gasping for breath. That was May 2nd. The baby died hours later at the hospital. Blunt force head trauma was deemed the cause of death. The defendant was not arrested until 4 years later, after mother had unsuccessfully attempted to have the defendant admit to harming the child in recorded phone conversations. The medical examiner testified on direct that the baby was injured on May 2nd. But on cross, the medical examiner acknowledged the baby could have been injured on May 1st, when defendant had no contact with the baby. Other people had access to the baby on May 1st, but they weren't interviewed because the medical examiner had told the investigators the injuries occurred on May 2nd. The court wrote, given the equivocal medical evidence with respect to the time frame within which the fatal injuries could have been inflicted, the weakness of the circumstantial evidence, and the lack of direct evidence that defendant caused the victim's injuries, we conclude that the people failed to prove the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Next is the Rogers case. It's on pages 11 and 12. It's another case that was reversed because the conviction was found to be against the weight of the evidence. The Second Department determined the people did not prove that the defendant possessed a razor blade partially wrapped in tape with the intent to use it unlawfully against another. The court said, the people failed to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that the razor blade recovered from the defendant was designed, made, or adapted for use primarily as a weapon. There was no testimony by the detectives indicating that they knew, based on their experience, that the primary use of this type of instrument, by virtue of being wrapped in black tape, was as a weapon, or that they attempted to ascertain from the defendant the manner in which he utilized the blade. Furthermore, there was no evidence from which it could be inferred that the defendant considered the instrument to be a weapon. Next is the Shanks case on page 13. It deals with the adequacy of a waiver of the right to appeal, and this case was a little out of the ordinary because it was a waiver of appeal after a jury verdict as opposed to after a guilty plea. The third department, affirming defendant's conviction, determined the defendant may validly waive an appeal from a jury verdict. The court wrote, a defendant may waive his or her right to appeal from a jury verdict. The people set forth the terms of the post-verdict agreement on the record, including that defendant would waive his right to appeal for a sentencing commitment of time served. County court then engaged in a thorough colloquy with defendant, during which defendant acknowledged that he had discussed the agreement with his counsel to his satisfaction and he understood it. County court explained the right to appeal from the conviction and eventual sentence, distinguished it from the trial rights that defendant had exercised, and made clear that defendant was being asked to give it up as part of the agreement. Defendant confirmed that he understood all of this and orally waived his right to appeal. He further executed a written waiver that was handed up prior to sentencing, a document that included assurances that it had been signed by defendant in open court after consulting with defense counsel. We are satisfied, notwithstanding isolated uses of language more appropriate for a waiver executed as part of a plea agreement, defendant knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently waived his right to appeal. Next is the Hagen case on pages 13 and 14. The Third Department determined the Article 78 proceeding, which was brought by the district attorney against the trial judge in a criminal case seeking prohibition, should have been dismissed. The trial judge had ruled that the conversations between an attorney and the defendant at the scene of the crime were protected by attorney-client privilege. The Article 78 action sought to prohibit the judge from adhering to that ruling. At the time of this Article 78 proceeding, the criminal trial was over and defendant had been convicted. The matter was considered by the appellate court as an exception to the mootness doctrine. The court wrote, prohibition will not lie as a means of seeking collateral review of mere trial errors of substantive law or procedure, however egregious the error may be, and however cleverly the error may be characterized by counsel as an excess of jurisdiction or power. To allow review of such matters would have an array of negative impacts, encouraging gamesmanship, erecting an additional avenue of judicial scrutiny in a collateral proceeding, and frustrating the statutory or even constitutional limits on review. Next is the Gannon case on pages 14 and 15. Here, evidence was seized from the defense attorney's office under the crime fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege. Third Department, affirming defendant's predatory sexual assault against a child and child pornography convictions, noted that evidence was seized from the Saratoga County Public Defender's Office, and the evidence was admissible at trial pursuant to the crime fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege. The facts are not described in any detail in the case. The court wrote, with respect to defendant's claim of attorney-client privilege, we find that the crime fraud exception applied because there was reasonable cause to believe that the items seized pursuant to the search warrant constituted physical evidence of a crime, and that their delivery to counsel was for the purpose of concealing evidence, not for seeking legal advice. Next is the Diamond case on page 18. It has to do with a finding that defendant had violated her plea agreement, and therefore a more severe sentence was imposed. Second Department held that the defendant was entitled to further inquiry into whether she violated the terms of her plea agreement. The defendant was not sentenced in accordance with the agreement based solely on the prosecutor's assertion she had not successfully completed a mental health court program. The court wrote, County Court failed to conduct an inquiry sufficient to assure that the defendant had, in fact, violated the terms of the plea agreement and that the information upon which it based the sentence was reliable and accurate. We remit the matter for a sufficient inquiry and a new determination as to whether the defendant violated the terms of the plea agreement and for resentencing. Moreover, as acknowledged by the people, County Court should not have pronounced sentence without first receiving a pre-sentence investigation report. Next is the Glover case, pages 18 and 19. It's a guilty plea case, the Third Department, reversing County Court and vacating defendant's guilty plea over a two-justice concurrence and a dissent, exercised its interest of justice appellate jurisdiction because defendant was not fully informed of the rights she was giving up by entering a guilty plea. The court wrote, in a notably brief plea colloquy, County Court advised defendant that by pleading guilty, she would forever relinquish the right to go to trial, the right to testify, to call witnesses, and to cross-examine the people's witnesses. There was no discussion of the privilege against self-incrimination or the right to be tried by a jury, nor was there any inquiry into whether defendant had conferred with counsel and understood the constitutional rights she was automatically waiving by pleading guilty. While there is no mandatory catechism required of a pleading defendant, there must be an affirmative showing on the record that the defendant waived his or her constitutional rights. As this record contains no such showing, the guilty plea is invalid. Next is the Wright case on pages 19 and 20, another guilty plea case. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction for a violation of the correction law, held that the plea allocution negated an essential element of the offense. Because the voluntariness of the plea was called into question, the issue survived the failure to move to withdraw the plea and the waiver of appeal. The court wrote, a sex offender is required to register with the division no later than 10 calendar days after any change of address and to pay a fee of $10 each time the offender registers any change of address. That's Correction Law Section 168-F, Subdivision 4. A sex offender who fails to so register within the required time period is guilty of a felony. That's Correction Law Section 168-T. The court wrote, the defendant indicated that he provided the division with the address of a homeless shelter that he was using, although he acknowledged that there were some nights when he couldn't stay at the shelter. He explained, sometimes if you don't get there in time, all the beds are taken, so sometimes you get turned away. On those days, defendant asserted he stayed at a friend's house instead. These statements tended to demonstrate that the defendant did not, in fact, change his address and thus was not required to notify the division. Next is Robles on pages 20 and 21. It's an identification evidence case. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction in the interest of justice, held a witness's testimony about a lineup identification procedure in which the witness indicated only that she was leaning toward choosing the defendant was inadmissible. court wrote, the foundational requirements of Criminal Procedure Law 60.25 were not met. Criminal Procedure Law 60.25 is principally concerned with cases where a witness who has validly identified a defendant on a prior occasion is, nevertheless, unable to make a trial identification due to a lapse of memory, permits a witness to testify in a criminal proceeding about his or her own prior identification, where the witness is unable at the proceeding to state on the basis of present recollection whether or not the defendant is the person in question. The witness never identified the defendant at the lineup, and thus there was no prior identification for her to testify about under Criminal Procedure Law 60.25. Next is DelCid, which is on page 21. It has to do with the requirement that inclusory concurrent counts be dismissed. Second Department vacated defendant's conviction of two inclusory concurrent counts alleging aggravated operation of a motor vehicle in the first degree. The court wrote, the counts alleging driving while intoxicated as a felony in violation of Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 1192, Subdivision 3, and aggravated unlicensed operation of a motor vehicle in the second degree were inclusory concurrent counts of the count alleging aggravated unlicensed operation of a motor vehicle in the first degree. And the courts cited Criminal Procedure Law 300.30, Subdivision 4, 300.40, Subdivision 3B, Vehicle and Traffic Law, Sections 511, Subdivision 2A, Roman numeral 2, and Subdivision 3A, Roman numeral 1, and Section 1192. Accordingly, the defendant's convictions of driving while intoxicated as a felony in violation of Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 1192, Subdivision 3, and aggravated unlicensed operation of a motor vehicle in the second degree, and the sentences imposed thereon must be vacated, and those counts of the indictment dismissed. Next is Gabor Reki on page 22. It has to do with the sufficiency of the indictment. Third Department, reversing county court over a dissent, held the evidence of manslaughter presented to the grand jury was legally sufficient. Defendant allegedly provided very strong heroin to the victim, causing the victim's death. The court wrote, in order to find a defendant guilty of manslaughter in the second degree, the people are required to show that he or she recklessly caused the death of another person. That's Penal Law Section 125.15. Subdivision 1. A person acts recklessly with respect to a result or to a circumstance when he or she is aware of and consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk that such result will occur or that such circumstance exists. Given defendant's knowledge of the potency of the drugs that he was distributing and their potential lethality, it is evident that the nature of the risk involved was of such degree that defendant's failure to perceive it constituted a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in the situation, and that his actions were a sufficiently direct cause of victim's death for him to face the judgment of a jury. Next is the Espinoza case on pages 23 and 24. It deals with the validity or invalidity of an inventory search. Third Department, in this appeal by the people, held that the search of defendant's vehicle was not a valid inventory search and the related suppression motion was properly granted. The court said, although not fatal to the establishment of a valid inventory search, the people did not admit the relevant tow and impound policy into evidence. The people also failed to ask any substantive questions of the deputy sheriff to establish that the policy was sufficiently standardized, that it was reasonable, and that the deputy sheriff followed it in this case. The deputy sheriff only vaguely stated that he conducted the inventory search, radioed for a tow truck, and completed the vehicle impound inventory report in accordance with the policy. Further, although the deputy sheriff filled out the impound inventory report, which indicates that the inventory search began at 9:55 a.m., he testified that the search began prior to that time and did not provide any explanation for the discrepancy. Moreover, there was contradictory testimony as to where the deputy sheriff found defendant's wallet, inside the vehicle or on defendant's person. Significantly, if defendant's wallet was inside the vehicle, as the deputy sheriff testified that it was, then the deputy sheriff allegedly took the wallet out of the vehicle but did not include it in the vehicle impound inventory report. In short, the people did not establish the circumstances under which searching the wallet and the closed trunk was justified under the policy. Next is Ramsey on pages 24 and 25. It has to do with excessive interference in the trial by the judge. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held the judge's intervention usurped the roles of the attorneys and deprived defendant of a fair trial. Defense counsel did not object, but the issue was considered on appeal in the interest of justice. The court said, when the trial judge interjects often and indulges in an extended questioning of witnesses, even where those questions would be proper if they came from trial counsel, the trial judge's participation presents significant risks of prejudicial unfairness. In this case, Supreme Court engaged in extensive questioning of witnesses, usurped the roles of the attorneys, elicited and assisted in developing facts damaging to the defense on direct examination of the people's witnesses, bolstered the witnesses' credibility, interrupted cross-examination, and generally created the impression that it was an advocate on behalf of the people. Next is the Hernandez case on pages 26 and 27. It deals with a for-cause challenge to a juror and also with the suppression of statements made by the defendant. The Fourth Department, reversing defendant's conviction and granting a new trial, held that a defense for-cause challenge to a juror should have been granted. Unworn statements made by the defendant in his home were in response to custodial interrogation, and the statements made at the police station were made after defendant invoked his right to counsel. The court wrote, by repeatedly insisting that police officers were unlikely to lie under oath because doing so would endanger their pensions, the prospective juror cast doubt on her ability to render a fair verdict under the proper legal standards and to follow the court's instructions concerning, at a minimum, issues of witness credibility. Turning to the suppression arguments, the court said, it is undisputed that defendant was ordered out of his bedroom by police officers in the middle of the night. He was directed to remain in a vestibule outside his apartment and thereafter was subjected to pointed accusatory questions for about an hour. Under those circumstances, we agree with defendant that a reasonable person, innocent of any crime, would not have felt free to leave, and that he was thus in custody during the questioning. Defendant unequivocally invoked his right to counsel by stating, I think I will take the lawyer, or I think I need a lawyer. We agree with defendant that his statements following his unequivocal invocation of his right to counsel at the police station should have been suppressed as well. Next is the Blunt case on page 17. It deals with a motion to set aside the verdict because a juror may have been biased. Fourth Department held defendant's motion to set aside the verdict based upon a connection between a juror and the defendant's mother shouldn't have been denied without a hearing. The court said, the court erred in summarily denying his motion to set aside the verdict pursuant to Criminal Procedure Law 330.30, Subdivision 2. The sworn allegations in support of defendant's motion including those in the affidavit of his mother, indicated that a juror may have had an undisclosed, potentially strained relationship with the mother resulting from attending high school and working together, possibly knew about defendant's criminal history, and purportedly attempted to speak with the mother's husband during a lunch break at trial, and that the alleged misconduct was not known to the defendant prior to the rendition of the verdict. We conclude that the allegations required a hearing on the issue whether the juror's alleged misconduct prejudiced a substantial right of the defendant. We therefore hold the case, reserve decision, and remit the matter to county court to conduct a hearing on defendant's 330-30 motion. Next is the Grimes case on page 28. It has to do with jury notes. Fourth Department, reversing the conviction, held the record was not sufficient to determine how the trial court handled notes from the jury, and reversal was therefore required. The court said, reversal is required as a result of the absence of record proof that the trial court complied with its meaningful notice obligation under Criminal Procedure Law 310.30 in response to two substantive jury notes. Here, the stenographer was unable to transcribe the final day of the trial that included county court's handling of the jury notes due to an error that rendered the subject electronic stenographic notes unrecoverable, and a reconstruction hearing failed to establish the court's on-the-record handling of those notes. We cannot assume that the proper procedure was utilized when the record is devoid of information as to how jury notes were handled. We therefore reverse the judgment and grant a new trial. Next is the Marischaw case on pages 29 and 30. It deals with the justification defense and whether the weapon involved in this case was properly considered to be a dangerous instrument. First Department held defendant's request for a jury instruction on the ordinary non-deadly force justification defense in this assault second prosecution was properly denied. The defendant didn't request a jury instruction on the deadly force justification defense. Defendant's use of a pen to puncture the victim's cheek constituted the use of a dangerous instrument, the court wrote. The video surveillance captures the defendant reaching into his bag or pocket with his right hand and then immediately striking the complainant with the same hand. Photographs of the complainant's cheek reflect what appears to be a puncture of the cheek. The photograph of the outside of the complainant's cheek shows that there was a thin horizontal cut adjacent to the round through-and-through puncture on the complainant's cheek, consistent with a sharp object, such as the point of a pen, scratching the complainant's cheek before the object plunged into it. Under the facts presented, the only possible justification charged that would have been available to defendant would have been a charge of justifiable use of deadly, not ordinary, physical force. Next is Smith on pages 30 and 31. It's another justification defense case, Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held that the failure to include the justification defense on the verdict sheet may have led the jurors to believe they had to reconsider the justification defense for each count. The judge had correctly instructed the jurors to acquit on all counts if the justification defense applied, but the omission from the verdict sheet was enough to call the verdict into question. The court wrote, Supreme Court properly instructed the jurors to consider justification as an element of each count submitted for their consideration. The court also properly instructed the jurors that they must find the defendant not guilty of all counts if they found that the people failed to disprove the defendant's justification defense. However, the verdict sheet didn't mention justification and instructed the jurors to continue to the following count if they found the defendant not guilty of count 1, 2, 3, or 4. Therefore, the Supreme Court's instructions, taken together as a whole, may have led the jurors to conclude that deliberation on each crime required reconsideration of the justification defense, even if they had already acquitted the defendant of the previous count based on justification. Next is Daniels on page 31, another justification defense case, Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the jury was not properly instructed on the justification defense. The defendant was acquitted of the top count, attempted murder, and was convicted of attempted assault first, a lesser included offense. The jury was not told that an acquittal on the top count based upon the justification defense required an acquittal on all the counts to which the justification defense applied. The issue was not preserved, but was considered in the interest of justice. The court said, the court's instructions, together with the verdict sheet, failed to adequately convey to the jury that if it found defendant not guilty of attempted murder in the second degree based on justification, it was not to consider the lesser counts to which the justification defense applied. Next is the Vail case on page 32. It's a kidnapping case, Fourth Department, over a concurrence and a dissent, held the jury instruction on the intent element of kidnapping was wrong, requiring reversal. Defendant, who was over 21, drove to Florida with the victim, who was 14, and had sex with her during the trip. The victim asked defendant if she could come with him and snuck out of the house without her mother's knowledge. The concurrence argued the restraint element of kidnapping was not proven, but agreed with the majority because that element had been conceded by the defense. The dissent would have reversed and dismissed the indictment, finding the conviction was against the weight of the evidence. The court wrote, the weight of the evidence supports a determination that defendant did not innocently acquiesce to the mere request of a 14-year-old acquaintance to drive her to Florida, but rather took advantage of a 14-year-old child's age and inexperience by driving the victim across multiple state lines away from her family in order to engage in an unlawful sexual relationship with the child. We interpret the statute to mean that kidnapping in the first degree requires that a defendant both restrain a victim for more than 12 hours and possess for more than 12 hours during the period of restraint the intent to violate or abuse the victim sexually. Here, however, the court instructed the jury that intent does not require advanced planning, nor is it necessary that the intent be in the person's mind for any particular period of time. We conclude that the instruction was erroneous, inasmuch as it permitted the jury to find that the element of intent pursuant to section 135.25, subdivision 2A, had been established, even if the jury did not find that the intent existed for more than 12 hours during a period of over 12 hours of restraint. From the dissent wrote, under these circumstances, it cannot be said that defendant either secreted or held the victim in his car, or that he intended to prevent her liberation. She was there voluntarily and of her own accord, which is the very antithesis of being secreted or held somewhere. That was from the dissent. Next is the Ted B. case on page 33. It's a mental hygiene law case concerning the commitment of a sex offender. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the expert testimony offered by the state did not demonstrate the appellant sex offender was unable to control his behavior, requiring civil commitment, as opposed to having difficulty controlling his behavior, requiring strict supervision. Therefore, the appellant should be released under a regimen of strict and intensive supervision. Next is Sachs on page 34. It deals with evidence of prior uncharged offenses and the prompt outcry exception to the hearsay rule. Third Department, reversing county court, held that detailed evidence of prior uncharged sexual offenses was not admissible under Molyneux. The defendant was charged with criminal sexual acts, alleging defendant asked a 6 or 7 year old boy to perform oral sex. The people presented in their direct case the testimony of 2 female relatives of the defendant, alleging sexual offenses occurring more than 7 years before the victim's disclosure in this case. County court also erroneously allowed hearsay about the victim's disclosure 2.5 years after the alleged incident under the prompt outcry exception to the hearsay rule. Next is the Lloyd case on page 35. It has to do with a parole search. Fourth Department held that the ammunition seized during a warrantless parole search of defendant's residence and which was connected to a shooting was not subject to suppression. At the time of the search, defendant's post-release supervision had been imposed administratively and not by a judge, a procedure which has since been rendered invalid by statute. The Fourth Department held that under these facts, the exclusionary rule, which usually requires suppression of the fruits of a warrantless search, would have no deterrent effect and need not be applied. The court wrote, when the parole search took place in 2007, the issue whether it is proper for the state to administratively impose post-release supervision had not yet been settled. More importantly, it is now settled as a matter of state statutory law that only a court may lawfully pronounce a term of post-release supervision as a component of a sentence. Consequently, all the relevant government actors are now well aware of the law. Under the circumstances, the deterrent effect of applying the exclusionary rule is marginal or non-existent. The next case is Jennings, which is on page 36. It's another parole search case. The First Department, reversing the suppression court in an appeal by the people, held the handgun found during a search of defendant's bedroom pursuant to a parole warrant should not have been suppressed. The parole officer testified she was searching a closet to see if defendant was hiding there when she felt a handgun in the pocket of a jacket she had seen the defendant wearing. The court wrote, we find that parole officer Williams, whose testimony the hearing court credited, acted lawfully in retrieving the firearm from defendant's jacket pocket. While executing a valid parole warrant, and in the course of searching for defendant pursuant to that warrant, Williams inadvertently felt an object that both she and her supervisor believed to be a gun in the jacket pocket. Because parolees are not permitted to possess firearms, Williams' discovery meant that defendant was in further violation of the conditions of his supervised release. Thus, the minimally invasive step of retrieving the gun from the pocket was rationally and reasonably related to the performance of her duty as defendant's parole officer. Next is the Aotunji case on pages 36 and 37. It has to do with the requirements for revocation of probation. Fourth Department, reversing county court, held defendant's probation should not have been revoked absent a hearing or an admission. The court wrote, a court may not revoke a sentence of probation without finding the defendant has violated a condition thereof and affording him or her an opportunity to be heard. That's Criminal Procedure Law 410.70, Subdivision 1. The statutory requirements may be satisfied either by conducting a revocation hearing pursuant to CPL 410.70, Subdivision 3, or through an admission by the defendant of the violation, coupled with a proper waiver of his or her right to a hearing. Here, as the people correctly concede, defendant never admitted to violating his probation, and the court never conducted a revocation hearing. Next is Brown on page 37. It's a sentencing case where the appellate division exercised its interest of justice jurisdiction to reduce the defendant's sentence. The Fourth Department held that although defendant met the criteria for a persistent felony offender, he shouldn't have been sentenced as a persistent felony offender due to the nature of his prior offenses. His sentence was reduced from 15 to life to 9 to 18 years. The defendant had been offered a 2.5 to 5 year sentence prior to trial. The court wrote, a determination by the appellate division to vacate a harsh or severe persistent felony offender finding is authorized by Criminal Procedure Law 470.20, Subdivision 6, which grants the appellate division discretion to modify sentences in the interest of justice without deference to the sentencing court. In another reduction of sentence by the appellate court, the McCoy case on page 38, the Fourth Department reduced defendant's sentence from 12 to 5 years, taking into account the plea offers, the lack of any prior felony convictions, her mental health problems, and the victim's opposition to incarceration. Next is the Weir case, pages 38 and 39. It's a Sex Offender Registration Act case, Fourth Department, held that defendant's waiver of appeal was invalid, but rejected her argument that she was exempt from the SORA registration requirement because she is the parent of the kidnapping victim who had been adopted by another family. The court wrote, "We conclude that defendant, the biological mother of an adopted child who she kidnapped, is not a parent of the victim for the purposes of the Sex Offender Registration Act, and thus defendant is not exempt from the SORA registration." Next is Johnson on pages 39 and 40, another Sex Offender Registration Act case, Third Department, over a two-justice concurrence, held defendant sex offender in this habeas corpus proceeding was not entitled to release on parole on the ground that the law prohibiting him from residing within 1,000 feet of school grounds was unconstitutional. Petitioner's sex offenses involved adults, not children. The court wrote, "Petitioner may or may not be correct when he says that the mandatory condition does not achieve its legitimate goals, but the argument that there are better or wiser ways to achieve the law's stated objectives must be addressed to the legislature. The mandatory condition comports with substantive due process, and petitioner is not entitled to immediate release." Next is the Covington case on page 40, another Sex Offender Registration Act case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant should not have been adjudicated a sex offender in New York based upon a murder conviction in Virginia, where he was required to register as a sex offender under Virginia law. The defendant was convicted of murdering a 3-year-old child who had suffered trauma to his genitalia. The court wrote, "The victim's extensive injuries in this case included significant traumatic injuries to his scrotum and penis, which were described at trial by the prosecution's expert medical witness as having been inflicted within hours to one day from the time of the infant's death, and were caused by blunt force trauma, probably squeezing. Nevertheless, as the people correctly concede, the order appealed from must be reversed in light of the Court of Appeals' recent opinion in People v. Diaz, which is 32 New York 3rd, 538, which held that mandatory registration as a murderer under Virginia Code Section 9.1-902D does not qualify the defendant as a sex offender within the meaning of Correction Law Section 168A, Subdivision 2D2. Next is the Hodgdon case on pages 41 and 42. It has to do with the powers of special prosecutors. In this case, the special prosecutor worked for the Justice Center for Protection of People with Special Needs. Third Department, in a full opinion by Justice Rumsey, held that the special prosecutor did not have the authority to prosecute a substance abuse counselor who allegedly sexually abused a 16-year-old patient. The special prosecutor was from the Justice Center for Protection of People with Special Needs. Because the special prosecutor did not have the knowing and express consent to the prosecution by the district attorney, the indictment was dismissed. The court wrote, "In 2012, The legislature enacted the Protection of People with Special Needs Act, which is Executive Law Section 550, to protect individuals who are vulnerable because of their reliance on professional caregivers to help them overcome physical, cognitive, and other challenges, by creating a new state agency, the Justice Center, and mandating, among other things, that it employ a special prosecutor appointed by the governor to investigate and prosecute criminal offenses involving abuse and neglect of vulnerable persons by employees of specified types of facilities and service agencies. Although the Act specifically authorizes the special prosecutor to exercise all the powers and perform all the duties in respect of such actions or proceedings, which the district attorney would otherwise be authorized or required to exercise or perform, it also prohibits the special prosecutor from interfering with the ability of district attorneys at any time to receive complaints, investigate, and prosecute any suspected abuse or neglect. There is no constitutional support for the legislature's attempt to provide for the gubernatorial appointment of a non-elected special prosecutor independent of the district attorneys and with unfettered prosecutorial power. We turn to consideration of whether the Albany County District Attorney validly consented to prosecution of defendant by the special prosecutor. The district attorney did not exercise his essential prosecutorial power to determine whether defendant should be prosecuted, but rather merely acquiesced in the prosecution by the special prosecutor, whom he mistakenly believed already possessed the independent power to prosecute defendant. Second, the district attorney failed to expressly retain ultimate responsibility for defendant's prosecution. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this July 2019 Criminal Law Update CLE. The verification code is special. Again, the verification code for this July 2019 Criminal Law Update CLE is special. Next is the Johnson case on page 42. It's a speedy trial case, Fourth Department reversing Supreme Court, dismissing the indictment on speedy trial grounds, held the 87-day delay during which the people sought a superseding indictment was attributable to the people despite their ready-for-trial announcement and despite the absence of a specific request for an adjournment. The court wrote, "The period of delay was attributable to the people's inaction and directly implicated their ability to proceed to trial on a charge of criminal possession of a controlled substance in the fifth degree, the crime that the people sought to add by way of a superseding indictment, and the sole crime for which defendant was ultimately convicted. Contrary to the court's determination, the 87-day period was not attributable to the court, given that it was the people's inaction in securing a superseding indictment that resulted in a delay in the court's trial of the action. Contrary to the people's contention, it is well established that post-readiness delay may be assessed notwithstanding that the people have answered ready for trial within the statutory time limit, and notwithstanding the absence of an explicit prosecutorial request for an adjournment. Although certain periods of time may be excluded from assessment as post-readiness delay, where the people successfully invoke one of the exceptions enumerated in Criminal Procedure Law 30.30 Subdivision 4, the people have identified no exception that might excuse the 87-day delay at issue here." Next is the Jones case on page 43. It's a street stop case, Fourth Department, vacating the guilty plea, dismissing the indictment, determined the handgun discarded by the defendant during a police chase should have been suppressed. The police were responding to information that a black male had discharged a weapon. There were several black males in the area, and nothing indicated defendant was involved in criminal activity. The defendant did not abandon the weapon because it was discarded in response to police illegality. The court wrote, "Although the officer observed defendant walking in the general vicinity of the reported gunshots, that observation does not provide the requisite reasonable suspicion in the absence of other objective indicia of criminality that would justify pursuit, and no such evidence was presented at the suppression hearing. In the absence of other identifying information, the fact that defendant may have matched the vague generic description of the suspect as a black male, which could have applied to any number of individuals in the area of the large apartment complex with hundreds of residents, did not sufficiently indicate that defendant may have been engaged in criminal activity. Therefore, the pursuit of the defendant was not lawful. Next is the Campbell case on page 44. It has to do with testimonial hearsay and so-called summation witnesses. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held that the testimony of two police officers, qualified by the court as gang experts, about information gleaned from interviewing gang members was testimonial hearsay in violation of Crawford, and the police experts acted as summation witnesses in violation of Iona. The court wrote, during the trial, Supreme Court declared Detective Adam George an expert in the hierarchy, practices, and languages of the Snow Gang and other gangs. Similarly, the court declared Lieutenant Robert Bracero an expert in the history, hierarchy, practices, and language of the Snow Gang and rival gangs. George testified that his knowledge of the Snow Gang was derived from, among other things, approximately 70 to 80 debriefings of Snow Gang members, many of whom had been arrested and were in custody at the police station or in jail. Similarly, Bracero testified that he debriefed approximately 50 Snow Gang members after their arrests. The defendant contends that George's and Bracero's testimony violated Crawford v. Washington, which is 541 U.S. 36, by permitting the introduction into evidence of out-of-court testimonial statements made by absent witnesses who were never subjected to cross-examination, and that George's testimony also ran afoul of the proscription against police experts acting as summation witnesses in violation of People versus Ainoa, 25 New York 3rd, 466, pages 474, 475. The testimony of George and Pichero violated Crawford and Ainoa, since the evidence of the defendant's guilt without reference to the errors was far from overwhelming. These errors were not harmless. And the last case is Turner on page 45. It's a youthful offender case. Third Department held that the youthful offender adjudication for one charge did not require the court to adjudicate defendant a youthful offender for an unrelated charge, even though both charges were subject to a joint plea agreement. The court wrote, although both accusatory instruments were ultimately resolved under a joint agreement, defendant pleaded guilty to two separate superior court informations, and the record does not reflect that either party moved to consolidate them, that they were ordered joined for trial, or that they could have been properly joined. Consequently, the sentencing court was authorized in its discretion to determine that the defendant was a youthful offender with respect to either or both convictions and was not compelled to confer youthful offender status at sentencing on both convictions. So that concludes this CLE, which is based on the decisions released in July 2019 addressing issues related to criminal law.